the Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome once again to All the Rage. Love and solidarity, as ever, every week to all of you out there during these very troubling times. We wish you the best. And this week, again, I'm very, very happy to say that we have another interview for you. Please introduce yourselves.
I'm Marco. For the last 4 years, I worked as a Tesco driver, delivery driver. I was a union rep at my depot as well.
Yeah, I'm Kieran. So for the last 4 years, I've worked in a food factory in Park Royal, which is in West London. And my food factory made ready meals for all the major supermarkets. So it's a pretty big deal, pretty big company. And we got a lot of kind of experiences working there, and kind of together we're part of another collective which is called Angry Workers. So we have been around for about 6 years, and we moved to West London about 6 years ago, and the idea was that we thought it would be interesting to get jobs in places that we thought were politically interesting, and basically kind of start an inquiry, meaning like finding out what actually is the working class doing. You know, like, it's all very well for the left to kind of think, oh yeah, we just need to join a trade union, or we just need to join the Labour Party, or we just need to do this or build a social movement or whatever. And I think in a lot of that kind of discussion, what gets lost is, yeah, like, what actually is the class doing, and how do we kind of, how do we move? And that is always our starting point, you know? So the idea is to kind of work in bigger workplaces and basically find out, like, what is going on. And from that point, kind of think about what we can do to, like, organise with our co-workers.
It's great to meet people who have actually done something that crossed my mind about 15 years ago. And I went, oh, well, you know, I'm all right at the post office. I think I'll stay here. Big mistake that was. Excellent work. So I first specifically came across your work in a magazine, Workers Wild West magazine, newspaper. Tell us a little bit about that. When did you kind of plan to publish something like that off the top when you started these jobs, or did that come to you like while you were working in these places?
I think it was somehow part of the plan, in the sense that we thought we have to find new ways to create a communication between workers' direct experiences. So, like, anything that is, you know, happening in the workplace informally or formally, workers reflect on it and exchange it as their experience. So that was one side. The other thing was that we thought a lot of lefty newspapers are quite preachy. We thought we need a new language to talk about the system, because we realized over the last, I would think, like 10 years at least, since the financial crash really, that more workmates start to think about what is the system. I mean, they realize it's a global kind of thing. What happens in the other part of the world is affecting us, relocation of production, the financial crash, climate change, war on terror. I mean, all of a sudden, millions are thrown into a debate that is mainly like coming from YouTube and these kind of things. So a lot of kind of weird theories out there. And we thought, okay, we have to find a new language to talk about, you know, from a working class point of view, what do we think is the system? You know, how did it grow like historically? So we wanted to kind of combine a very direct experience of workers in the workplace with some political ideas of ours about, you know, this society and how we can create a better one. So that was the idea roughly behind the newspaper. But apart from the newspaper, I mean, there were basically four different levels that we tried to organize ourselves with, you know, people that we met or other comrades. So the first level was, or the first layer was, a solidarity network, because we realized that where we work, the jobs, it's 90% migrant workers, you know, Eastern European, South Asian, English is on a medium. So we need a network where people can come, and we just support each other. It's not a charity. It's not a service as such. We emphasize, yeah, we here we have no financial interest. We are not experts. We know a bit about the law, but like it's mainly direct action. So if people have trouble with the landlord, temp agency, we support each other. And yeah, we had, that was like the bottom rung of that organizational process.
And I think the other thing is, because a lot of people around here kind of have problems with like their landlord or not getting paid the correct wages from their temp agency and all that stuff, like if their kind of reaction is to kind of say, oh, we need to go to a lawyer, we need to go to a solicitor, you know, and kind of use these professional services. And a lot of the times they get ripped off, you know, like I had a co-worker who needed a letter written in English for a disciplinary, and she went to like Wembley High Road, and some lawyer basically charged her 70 quid to write a letter in English. And when I looked at the letter, the English was crap, you know, so we didn't even do a very good job. So it's like, how do you kind of say, look, we can't rely on these like kind of other people to like, because we can actually do quite a lot ourselves, you know, and a lot of it is just about getting together and kind of feeling like you can actually do something and you don't need to pay for it, and you don't need to like ask someone else to do something on your behalf.
Yeah, and you don't need many resources. We had three drop-ins, so every Monday we would meet a different place. One was McDonald's, like it's free, you can sit there, you know, people drop in, it's nearby the industrial areas. One in Indian tea restaurant type of thing in Southall, where a lot of workers live. And then at Asta in Park Royal, which is still one of the biggest industrial areas in Europe. I mean, people forget that, but it's about nearly 40,000 workers still. So we met in the supermarket cafe. And yeah, what we realized is that when the left likes to talk about the migrant community, but we realize this community is quite divided. I mean, there is a layer that, because like they came, let's say 50, 60 South Asian in our area, some of them really, you know, they made their way up into being landlords, small bosses, managers. And there's a lot of internal exploitation of people who just arrived. So somehow like we also wanted to make sure that there's a connection between the more organized segment of the working class and people who are normally marginalized and then depend on the middle class for, you know, to get a job or to help. And this kind of cross-class connection is often like quite exploitative. So yeah, that was the idea behind the solidarity network.
And it was also kind of a way to meet people like outside of work, but because everyone in this area normally like lives and works in this area, you know, you can kind of get to know people, then you get to find out about, oh, you know, they've got a problem with their landlord, but actually they work in this big warehouse over here, and then a year later they move to another place, and if there's a problem there, then they get back in touch. And it's just a way of kind of having an ear on the ground about like what's happening.
I think the danger in general is with these solidarity networks that you become like it's just one individual case after the other. So we really try to kind of ask people that we are like, where are you currently working? What's happening at your workplace now? Even if it was to get the money from the last job, from the last boss, it was like, okay, where are you now? And we got to know like some Punjabi truck drivers, and they started working in very small companies where it was about even getting the minimum wage. But some of them moved to work at Alpha LSG, which is like the second biggest airline caterer in the world. So all of a sudden you had a group of workers in a situation where at Alpha LSG, the newly hired workers get much less than the older staff. So they were a bit pissed off. We already knew them a bit. So you create kind of connections that, you know, can collectivize the dispute. It's not just like individual cases. So which brings us more or less to the second level, which was for us the focus on the workplace. So let's say with 4, 5, 6 people, we worked in about, yeah, I would think about 25 different workplaces in the area. I mean, we stayed longest 4 years in, you know, at Tesco Warehouse and Bakavo, but we worked in other areas and comrades worked here and there. So we approached the situation fresh in the sense like our aim is that workers look at the situation and their collective power, given by the way the work is organized, how the company depends on them, the given division in the workforce. And, you know, after that analysis together, you know, with our co-workers, then we can say, like, okay, what is the best thing to do here? Because often, like, especially professional organizers, they come in and say, like, okay, this is the plan, let's do that. For us, it's important that also, like, a political thing, that workers start analyzing their own situation and don't rely on ready-made kind of methods that often make them dependent on some professionals or the apparatus. So in some situation, we joined the union. It was like a way to maybe meet other people. In other situations, we organized more informally. We can go through some examples if you want.
So there was three of us in this Sainsbury's chill warehouse. So it was this kind of massive fridge, basically, where you would kind of walk around with this like scanner thing on your arm. So you kind of looked a bit like this kind of budget Robocop, and you would kind of use it to scan like boxes and put boxes in cages and like push, you know, pulling pallets behind you with a pallet truck. So it was also really low tech. You know, like, I think people have this idea of, like, all warehouses, Ocado, everything's, like, automated and there's, like, loads of machines everywhere. But it was just, you know, you kind of didn't give you any equipment or any, like, warm jackets and stuff. Basically, you just had to go in your winter coat. I remember it being in the middle of summer, like, and you just get all your winter coat on and then, you know, you're pushing this kind of pallet behind you with this pallet truck that's always breaking down. So it was a pretty kind of crap job. And most of the people there were agency workers. And I think this is kind of a big gap in kind of organizing, because this is like a massive change that's happened in the workforce. Yeah. Like, you've got way more temp workers, like workers that, you know, you go through temp agencies to get a job. Unions haven't really been able to respond effectively to what is essentially like in many cases, a two-tier workforce. You know, they used to kind of undermine the permanent staff. They used to put pressure on the permanent staff. The workforce becomes even more divided than it was before. And because they're in that precarious position where, you know, they can be fired easily, and a lot of them are migrant workers as well, like in this area, and they feel like they don't have much of a voice, it's a very difficult situation. Like, how do you, in this kind of workplace and with these kind of pressures, do you like come together and do something? So that's why we were kind of interested in this workplace, because also it's like Sainsbury's, you know, it was a very big company, very well known. They use a logistics company to basically sort out the picking. So the warehouse is owned by a logistics company, but with the sole contract to deliver the stuff to Sainsbury's supermarkets. And then we're the temp agency that's employed by the logistics company. So you can see there's like three levels there, you know, but essentially we are working for Sainsbury's. But, you know, it doesn't feel like that, because they want to make you feel like somehow you're like not employed by Sainsbury's and that you're unimportant.
Yeah, it's a way of kind of splitting a company in a way where it's difficult to work out who you work for. Just quickly, I know I don't want to interrupt your flow, but just quick, another good example I often talk about with my dad, which was one of the great train crashes. I think it was Potter's Bar, one of those that happened in the last decade before last, whatever. And this terrible situation where they just tried to push responsibility all around the place. Well, it was a fault of the track. The track's owned by a different company. No, it wasn't a fault of the track. We think it was the fault of the station because it didn't have the right signals up. Well, the signals are owned by somebody else. Well, the station is co-managed by, you know, so it just, there's no responsibility. It just runs around the place.
So, you know, we were kind of working there thinking, okay, like, what's going on here? You know, like, how is the pressure being put on us? And it was just kind of all kinds of crazy things. And we write about this in the book. There's like a whole chapter about like what was going on there. And so you have the permanents that are earning about 2 or 3 quid more an hour than the agency workers. So everyone's really trying hard to get a permanent position, because for that kind of manual work, getting £9 something an hour, bear in mind this was about 5 years ago, was quite a lot, you know. And that's basically the most that you would have could expect to earn doing that kind of shit job. So once people got that permanent job, they didn't want anything to kind of mess it up, right?
Yeah, but I think you have to, like, the ratio between permanents and temps. So it was like in that, on one shift, you would have about 70 temp workers and I would say maybe 40 permanents. And the temp workers were on zero-hour contracts. You had a pick rate that was pretty high. It's kind of quite tough to achieve. And if you're in the lower third or in the picking order, so to speak, if your pick rate is in the lower third, they would cut your shifts for the next week. So there's a constant oversupply of the temp. So you're constantly kind of trying to get a bit up so you got secure shifts. This the pick rate, the productivity rate is sent to your mobile phone every day. So you will get like well done. You know you're at 100% or not so well done, and it's on the screen. So we can say all these poor workers, because like, you know, that's what the left normally likes, you know, to portray everyone as victims. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, a lot of these guys had the first job in the UK. They came there. That was their first job. And they thought maybe we can get into a permanent position. And in this situation, it was only two of us who joined Unite. I mean, it was the permanent workforce was organized with Unite. And two of us joined. But there didn't seem to be too much interest, basically, in organizing the temps. And now we can say, oh, why is that? I think Unite was fairly like happy to have a recognition agreement at all. They managed to get, you know, good membership amongst the permanents. They would think, oh, these temps, they leave after half a year anyway. Why should we organize them? They got the 2.5% wage increase a year. So they didn't want to rock the boat. And also, like, the reps were overworked. So they didn't come up with something where we could say, like, oh, these temps, if we just get them all in the union, then, you know, and ask for permanent contracts, things will be better. So we decided to organize like a slowdown.
Yeah, so we kind of go into more detail in the book about all the different types of things we did. I mean, how difficult it is just to get a group of workers together just to discuss what to do after work, you know, because everyone's running off here, there and everywhere. People want to go and smoke their spliff. People need to go and get their bus. They need to pick up their kid or whatever. How do you kind of agree to do something? And yeah, you know, we tried petitions, we kind of made announcements like during the briefing in front of everybody, and we've tried to involve as many people as possible, you know. And it did end up you know, that we had this kind of slowdown, which obviously management hated, and it was we decided on this course of action because it was a way that everyone could be involved. You didn't have to be a kind of hero or even say anything, you know. It was just everyone would just work slow for the hour, and it would have maximum impact on the company because the lorries would have to come at a certain time to pick up the delivery, and they would have to get to the supermarket at a certain time. And if they didn't, you know, meet those targets, then Sainsbury's would find them, yeah. You know?
We talk about 170 supermarkets in London that were like supplied by that warehouse. So it's not, even if the workers individually seem like very kind of weak, you know, their English is not great, they don't have much experience in the UK, 0 hour contracts. But like, instead of just focusing on that, we try to focus on, yeah, potentially there's quite a bit of power if such a big company like, in such a big town, depends on the work, you know.
And I think also a lot of workers just think, oh, it's like strike or nothing when they think of like workers action. It's like those are the like two options, do nothing or go on strike. But actually, it's very difficult to go on strike, especially in a bigger workplace, you know, if you have to do a kind of legal strike, you know, there's all these bureaucratic things that you have to go through and it takes time and people get demoralized. But actually there's loads of other stuff that you can do where you don't need to do that, you know? So these are the kinds of things where we're interested in a workplace where, yeah, it wasn't a situation where people could go on strike legally because they weren't in the union and the union wasn't interested in representing them.
Yeah. And back maybe to the Solidarity Network and that workplace action. I mean, ideally, and that is something that has to be developed, like, you know, continuously, ideally we would have had let's say 60, 70 people that we would have got to know through the Solidarity Network, other workers that we supported, that they would come out and support an initial action of the workers in that workplace. Because like from experience, we met, you know, many like workers, logistics workers in Italy that organized over the last 10 years. They said the initial action is often depends on support from the outside to just have people even to block, you know, the gates for a day or something like that. It can't substitute for a strike action, but like initially that kind of support is quite crucial. So we thought if we get the right relation or dynamic between a solidarity network locally and these kind of workplace activities, something might be possible. And we wanted to reflect on that with the newspaper. So these kind of three layers somehow organically somehow would relate to each other. So that was like roughly the idea.
So, I mean, we kind of critically reflect on like that action in the book, because even though it kind of worked in the sense of like really scaring management, and also they did end up getting workers did get a pay rise then a short time afterwards. Although obviously they didn't admit that that was the reason why, but things have been building up for a while, you know.
They never do admit it, but yeah.
Yeah, but they also, I mean, it's also good for workers to see that management did take them seriously, you know, like management had never seen anything like this before. And that's the thing, in a lot of these workplaces, managers are really like on the back foot because it's such a kind of low ebb of struggle, really, that they're not expecting anything. They just think, oh yeah, you know, we'll just carry on like this. And so when workers do something together, they like freak out.
Yeah, I just to put a point there, I do think management culture now is one that has been understandably bred the idea into it that workers, especially when they're as fragmented, I think, as some of the workplaces you're discussing here, well, then they'll never get together. They'll never organise. They don't even talk to each other at break time, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think they've got that in their idea, and it's always certainly a great pleasure to me to see it when, like, the, you know, that very nice cardigan-wearing chap who was in charge of something at Deliveroo, and he came out to talk on the picket line a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And again, everyone was like, piss off, mate, you've got nothing to say to us. But he just looked a bit like he wasn't even annoyed. He just looked like, I don't understand this. What's happening?
Why are you so angry?
Yes, yeah. Why are these people so angry? I treat them so well.
So we try to reflect, for example, some of the experience from Italy, but also from comrades of ours in Poland at Amazon, and also have that in the newspaper. I mean, obviously, all lefty newspapers tend to have some international news, but we really try to relate these news to problems that occur in the modern workplace in our area. So really like try to relate and say like, okay, you know, here people say, oh, I can't do anything because I'm a migrant. But then you can say, yeah, but like, what about these migrant workers in Italy? I mean, they were able to enforce like wage increases of 30%. Yeah, but, you know, it's obviously, you know, people will always find like some reason why it's difficult to struggle. And we try to confront that, like in a dialogue type of thing.
But, and like, we haven't cracked it by any means. No. I mean, you know, like that action was successful in a lot of ways, but you can also say it was a failure because, you know, like me and Marco ended up getting sacked. But like, nobody else got sacked, but the amount of work management had to kind of put in, interviewing every single worker, you know, doing transcripts. We got like a ream of paper, like, you know, really thick through the post, you know, all the effort that had gone in just to like weed out like the troublemakers. And that was a kind of flaw in a way, because, I mean, it wasn't a situation where everyone was taking equal responsibility, you know, like it shouldn't have been like, oh, these are the leaders. And in a way, like, we weren't kind of the leaders in the sense of like, oh, yeah, telling everyone this is what we need to do. I mean, it was a kind of collective thing that was decided. There's always you know, a couple of people in the workforce that are just kind of will say some names. And management just wants some names, you know.
Also,
it's like if you're in a workforce where people stay for 6 months and then they go and move to another job, and everyone's on a kind of agency 0 hours contract, you know, that is a difficult thing to kind of organise. So we just kind of thought at one point, we've been there for 6 months. Actually, we're now the old timers, you know. So, so there's always every kind of 4 months or so, you'll get a group of people who are like more up for doing something, you know, who were a bit more kind of lively. And then you think, okay, well, should we use this opportunity or not? We can kind of wait. But then in a year from now, it'll be a totally new group of people. And you start, you know, you kind of say, okay, well, here's a moment, let's go for it and kind of see what happens without trying to put anybody at risk.
Yeah. Well, also, I think a benefit there is something I get from this, if I may say, is that you seem to have a similar aim that I often have, which is about changing the culture. So the culture is perhaps, of, as you say, the workplace where it's very, very temporary. People don't stay very long. And I remember when I started doing a lot of trade union work outside of my own union for people I just meet and come across, the first thing Dave said to me was, one of the first things you look at is what is their staff retention in this company. And if everyone's leaving after 3 months, that tells you a lot about the management. So it's kind of adjusting the idea of that, which is to say, I'm only here for a little while. I don't really care about any of this shit. I'm just here for a day's work or whatever. To the point where what would be better is, okay, if you're here for a month, 2 months, or you're here for 5 years, these are the decent standards, working conditions that you get as an employee, no matter which company in this spider's web technically is the one that employs you. We want this to be that, and therefore you don't get undercut, exploited, etc. Is that a fair assessment?
I would think if we contrast that situation with all the temp workers with the situation at Tesco, which was actually just neighboring that warehouse, so there are two different warehouses next to each other, and you could say Tesco, you know, obviously a union as well, Asto, they didn't use temp workers, they were all on flexi contracts, but Tesco permanent. The turnover is not that high, maybe amongst the drivers, I was a driver, it was a bit higher, but otherwise people tend to stay a bit longer. But again, if we look at the situation from the point of view of, you know, I mean, we have a political interest of workers' power. I mean, in the wider sense, if we think about we want to, you know, overcome capitalism and all that, it won't happen if workers can't, you know, self-organize their day-to-day struggle. I mean, it won't fall from the sky. If workers don't have the experience, we can actually, you know, beat the bosses at this point. There will be very little that they will think about a different society because, you know, if you can't even enforce your toilet break, who wants to talk about socialism or whatever you want to talk about? So if we look at Tesco, there as well, I mean, I was there for 4 years. I was the shop steward. But the fact that Tesco managed to get the union, you know, to sign a partnership agreement, there was no collective bargaining. The union was really more or less like a level of, you know, friendly co-management. But there was very little initiative just amongst workers to just say, okay, we're not happy about this, but we see it as a collective problem. You know, Tesco has got all these forms to individualize any kind of dispute. And if you, even as a shop steward, like formally, if you think, okay, my role is it, you know, to get people together if they have a common problem and basically defend their interest. But you get really stepped in the back by, you know, some of your own union officials. If you approach and they say, oh, this is not according to the partnership agreement. Okay, that's a lot of ranting. I'm just saying, just the fact that you've got a union and a fairly stable workforce itself doesn't say too much about, you know, how confident workers feel, how active they are. So as people who really, you know, believe that we have to, you know, get out of this, you know, polluting and exploiting system, to really look like what are workers experiencing and where can we, you know, start some self-activity, I think we have to shed a lot of the ideas that the left has about, yeah, once you've got the union, it's all sorted, or, you know, if workers are on temp contract, they can't do anything. I mean, it's like we really try to kind of question some of the kind of myths, you know, like people like to kind of see Amazon and Sports Direct as the bad ones, but, you know, working at Tesco or another kind of bit more formalized job might not be much different from a worker's point of view.
Yeah, indeed. And I find, I kind of noticed this anyway, but certainly through doing this show, where we've been fortunate enough to interview a lot of people in smaller size trade unions. So we've spoke to the United Voices of the World, and we've spoken to, we're kind of in the middle of a series of talking to people involved with the IWGB. That's going to go on sporadically all summer, hopefully. Those is that actually a lot of the smaller unions at the moment, I think, are doing a better job than the larger ones, including my own. I have a lot of criticisms of it. I don't think we are, it's a cliched word to say robust, but I don't think we are robust enough in a literal sense. We're not taking into account smaller scale worker needs, disagreements, the kind of stuff I think that you're talking about here. There is very much a kind of attitude of, well, we can't really organise over there very well. So we'll just not bother. We've actually had a couple of examples of other, for years, going back years, actually, a couple of lower level mail companies or those involved in mail processing. We're the only ones that do the proper process and delivery now, where we tried to set up and we basically fucked it up and didn't bother doing it properly. And, it was embarrassing. It looked bad, you know, and now we're in a situation where, I feel like the larger unions are losing ground. Whereas I look at the smaller unions, I look at the smaller self-organising groups that aren't even, perhaps even barely even describe themselves as a trade union, and they're making really important gains that are affecting people's everyday lives, stuff that really matters, you know, it's something that affects your material existence, the kind of stuff you're talking about.
And I think a large part of that is also because a lot of the smaller unions maybe don't get hung up on, you know, the things that normally the unions do get hung up on, like getting a formal recognition agreement, you know, that is the thing that then will tie your hands and make it more difficult for you to, like, perhaps go on strike or do, you know, take some kind of action because, you know, the contract was, the terms will kind of stipulate, oh, you know, you need to go through this formal process before you can, you know, actually get on strike. And it's like, okay, what's the point? Actually, you can go on strike without having the formal recognition agreement, and you can do it in a much more responsive way. And that's what workers want. Like, they need to see something being done immediately. You know, that's not to say that you don't plan for things and things don't just happen spontaneously. But I mean, the big unions are just working so slowly, you know, that it just, you kind of think, you know, they just want to drain people of that, like, initial energy and motivation because they're not interested in doing something.
Yeah, and I think it's also like that's, I mean, we didn't want to be like a union as such. We wanted to encourage also these, some of the smaller unions to avoid a certain trap, which is, as a union, because you're interested obviously in growing, which is understandable, that's somehow the job. You often, you know, you're compelled to portray that you're victorious because, you know, who would join a union if it's not victorious? You're supposed to, you know, you use certain methods that might, you know, get you some members quick, but, like, in the long run, it undermines some of the self-activity of the workers. So sometimes, or, like, there's a tendency that people get, like, the idea, oh, it's the organization that's powerful and not what workers are doing. You know, there's, at some point, there's a certain disconnect and there's a lack of self-reflection also in terms of the difficulties, you know, the, you know, what doesn't work. So we get presented a lot of, you know, this works and that works, but not, like, much reflection of, you know, what is actually our, what is day-to-day problem of workers. And behind the facade of the organization, this kind of critical self-reflection is not happening. And I think that was the aim of our book, was that as you know, working class, political working class people, we want to look at all the options that workers currently have and all the problems that they have. So we didn't say, oh, we are the organization that you have to organize in. We said, okay, in each situation, we'd see what we can do in order to push self-organization. And in some situations, like at Kieran's food factory, we tried it outside of the GMB, and then we tried like to open some space in the recognized union. So we had no like prefigured, you know, this is the organizational model. So I think that that is somehow the idea also of the book, is to encourage anyone who's kind of on the, you know, working class left to not have these kind of, you know, to reflect on according to the actual conditions that workers have, not their own ideas.
And I think, like, you know, a lot of people now are just kind of saying, oh, well, they've been they have been very successful, these small unions. So we just need to replicate that. You know, why didn't you just, you know, join IWGB or UVW in your workplace, and you could have had the success that they have? But there's no kind of discussion about actually what are the elements, what are the kind of objective, subjective factors that make those victories, you know, like what makes them successful? Because you can't just like transplant what they have done in a very kind of specific industry with a specific workforce, you know, using, you know, specific tactics, or, you know, and just say, okay, we can just do that in a big company where there is already a big mainstream union, a different workforce, and, you know, a kind of different, lots of different factors involved. So, you know, we're not trying to kind of belittle what those small unions have done. They've done an amazing job, and it's been a real beacon for the working class in general, that like something is moving. But, you know, it's not as easy as just like going, yeah, okay, let's just join UVW, you know, like and we go into quite a lot of detail in the book about that.
You can't apply it like a blueprint on the top of any workplace.
Yeah.
In the same way, you can't do it with the larger scale unions either.
Exactly. And I think there's also a certain, I mean, I think in the UK particularly, there's this kind of, the working class has these two legs. One is a trade union, the other one is the Labour Party. But we can also see that, you know, is working class life divided like that? Is there an economic life of the working class and a political life of the working class? I think that's kind of a bit of a strange, you know, division, that, you know, politically you know you're supposed to look at, you know, what's happening with the election, with the parliament, and then you've got the unions to take over the bread and butter issues that can depoliticize the workplace and what work is. So it's kind of, I think that politics is part of daily life. It's not something, you know, just about elections and all that. So that's what we wanted to emphasize, that the working class need their own political debate. We're not saying like, oh, we have to form a new party. We're saying like, we have to bring, you know, the discussion about the system, the, you know, what is the society we live in. We have to relate that very closely. What are our day-to-day struggles? How is the struggle against that particular boss, or you know, in that particular industry, related to bigger problems that are immediately political? If we see, for example, we're close to Heathrow. So we had, you know, some workmates who work at Heathrow, you know, many as low-wage workers. And obviously, immediately you have a debate like, oh, are you for the runway or not? You know, what about climate change? And again, you've got like, you know, very little attempts to say like, no, you know, workers who can't defend, you know, their conditions as low-wage workers, how can you expect like having a big discussion about, you know, you know, overcoming climate change? I mean, there's, in order to have that debate, people have to have some collectivity and some strengths, and that you can only build in day-to-day struggles, but you can't cut them off from the big debate about, are these jobs actually good, you know, or they're killing us, you know, we suffer from all the pollution in this area more than anyone else. So for us, it's about politics in daily life, and don't, you know, leave it to some NEC or leader debate or all that.
Yeah, I agree, actually. It is, again, a bit of a disconnect. Just on that subject, with your experience, because we've talked on this show quite a bit about alternative media.
I mean, we have the newspaper and stuff, but you don't get very much feedback from that, you know, because we distribute it at specific workplaces, and we know that discussions happen inside. So when the newspaper is distributed at my workplace, I can see people in the canteen discussing it, you know, but if I don't work at that workplace, and, you know, you don't know, and you don't get that much back. But, you know, when we had meetings where we brought different workers together, maybe from different departments or from different factories, you know, that was, I mean, that had never been done before. And you could see kind of that they felt, oh, the union is kind of showing some interest in like what we actually think. And even though our conditions are very similar to each other and we work in the same company, but we work on different sides of the road to each other, and they never get a chance to meet or discuss like actually what they could do together, because they would only ever be in a situation of strength if they managed to break that divide between kind of working in different departments or different factories. So getting a kind of regular group of people together to kind of discuss their situation is obviously kind of the best kind of means for workers to kind of carry on that discussion. But like actually getting those meetings to take place are very difficult, you know.
For example, as the drivers, we have WhatsApp, you know, you do like a quick chat about conditions and things or about other things. So, yeah, I think it depends pretty much, like, first of all, on the circumstances. Drivers can't really meet that often. But then also, like, you know, is it about a proper discussion or is it more about an exchange of information and things? But, yeah, to be honest, man, we had the hope, like, to if we have to start from scratch, we thought, okay, we have to go back times of the First International or some shit, like, where people have really, like, even, you know, we try to put on documentaries, discussions about that. Like, it's really difficult, to make the time for, you know, face-to-face meetings and actual discussions. So I think, yeah, there will be some role for social media. But at the same time, we are wary of, you know, it's so overused as, you know, oh, you've got 10,000 followers and that means something. It doesn't have to. I mean,
I think lots of people think, oh, there's a quick technological fix. You know, if you just get everyone on a WhatsApp group, if you get everyone on a Facebook group, then that will kind of solve the problem. And in some cases, that is really effective. Like, as you mentioned, the West Virginia teachers, when we were talking before we started this interview, you know, a lot of them got organized like through a Facebook group, you know, but in my workplace, the workforce were too kind of scared to put their name to something in a comment, because then they know that managers are watching and they might get a disciplinary for it. I mean, I know one guy was sacked because he kind of did a little Facebook video when he was in the factory. Someone told a manager and the next day he was out, you know. So there is also that fear around, you know, saying something on social media. So you can't really rely on that. I mean, it is a useful tool, but, you know, there's not going to be a kind of technological fix there.
Yeah. We've got like, we started after basically finishing this book, we started like a bit more of a network of collectives or groups that try to do similar work. It's called Let's Get Rooted. And we've got like in the next months the idea or the project to have detailed conversations with workers of all kind of sectors about the condition situation during the lockdown and now that they come out of the lockdown. And behind that is an idea that on one hand, you see the essential workers during the lockdown, they really felt like, okay, society actually, first of all, you know, you first, that our work becomes visible and appreciated. Okay, who cares about that? But like, we also have some power here. So like a lot of the normally low paid manual labor, delivery drivers, agriculture workers, you know, carers, there is some collective confidence that I think built during that lockdown and the role that they had. At the same time, we see that with the economic impact, unemployment is increasing. So there's a pressure from above on the wages. So I think over the next months, we will see a real field of tension around the question of, you know, the low wage sector with pressure from both sides.
Firstly, thanks for all you do. I think it's fantastic. And I kind of, you work in a part of the world that I grew up in, and you mentioned some stuff about Unite. I think they're too big, so you become, it's too big, in my opinion, and B, and it's something me and John have spoke about, I think some of our senior officials across the TUC are too old now, in my opinion, and I'd like to see some young people like yourselves come through.
They wouldn't let us come through.
No, they won't, because it's a club. So yeah. I don't speak to many socialists, because we're just going to agree on everything. What's the point? What's the point of me speaking to, fair play to them, and sell me their newspaper and stuff. Thank you very much, and we agree on everything in it. So really, I'm just buying it because I'm just buying it. The most left person I probably speak to is John, because he puts up and chats up on a lot of stuff that he deals with, and it kind of gives me an outward look rather than an inward look. And I get what you're saying about Unite. I just think they're too big. It's like a sea, you know. Once you're a union in Unite, you become lost. But what I would say to any young reps, and I think it's a fantastic job that you do, and you must give me the name of that book, because I'm going to just spread that name. What I'm saying is, look for your quick wins. I'm just saying, I'm not saying I know everything. I'm just saying, look for your quick wins, and that's your subject for your Zoom meetings. Because there'll be one thing, whatever it is, it can be anything from a coffee machine to wages, or that bad refrigeration unit, or health and safety. But look for one quick win that's a common denominator in your section of the workplace, and say, we're doing a Zoom meeting on that tonight. Just that. And just look for your quick win. Your passion is very clear, and I think you're going to win it. But look for your quick win. Secondly, tribunals or ACAS, try your hand at that. I see a lot of discrimination in Park Royal, for example. I see a lot of discrimination where people are treated differently. Now, there's a ruling, we're still in the EU, bear in mind, but there's Article 52, which talks about, so you can't have a workforce, one company on two different wages. So what Sainsbury's did is they created another company to get around that. But I would also claim discrimination with ACAS. Now, what I'm saying is that sometimes ACAS will come contact the company and say someone's actually wants to, because apparently you've got to conciliate first before you can go to tribunal. But it's just who has the bottle to do that. But you could actually say that you're that person's representative, and ACAS will recognise you as their representative. And that person never needs to speak. You could do that for them. But once that company gets contacted by ACAS, but just as an advice, you know, I'm an old man, I'm just saying, look for your quick win, and you will get your Zoom meetings in the evening. You don't have to go on social media. You can do your Zoom meeting. Now, remember, the Zoom meetings has changed everything, because we ran a country from Zoom. Now, remember, health and safety will never change the laws. So the 1974 Act says duty of care. That company is meant to show a duty of care. And I always find with health and safety, it's non-negotiable. Well, and as you mentioned, COVID, it's how we use this, because people have recognised they were actually more important than a hedge fund billionaire. They weren't packing the food, they weren't driving the buses, they weren't driving the tubes, and they weren't delivering the packets and the mail. And people are recognised that this is just how we do that. But yeah, fair play to you. I think it's a great, it's different. It's just giving a different slant on, you didn't come on there representing a huge TUC organisation.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
No, I think at the moment a lot of discussions possible again. You know, like I remember I was working in Hackney on the bin space refuse collection during 2008 crisis, and that was the first time that in the trucks we had a discussion like, okay, what is actually happening? Like, what is money and what is all that finance and who's owning who money and how can you have so much debt? And that was like, you know, the first time that, you know, you have like discussion on that kind of level. Now with this COVID, I think it goes even deeper. People ask themselves like, so how come that only 30% of the jobs are really necessary in order to, you know, to create the means of a fairly good life? What are all the other jobs about, you know? And why do we still work 10 hours a day if actually we could all work much less? Because we can see that, you know, only 30% of the jobs are actually essential or necessary. The rest is pushing money around.
And as we know, me and I have discussed many occasions, Dave, you can't trust old people. We know that. So. And especially from the, especially anyone who made music in the 90s. You know my opinions on that.
In 68, they said, at least in Germany, don't trust anyone over 13. Was it something like
that? And thank you so much for coming. This has been a fascinating conversation. It's been a really inspiring conversation. So just tell us, just a couple of little things. Has there been any effect to yourselves or that you've noticed about the pandemic that we're in? Has it affected what you do? Or I know you're not in the same workplaces anymore, so perhaps it didn't affect you in that sense. But do you still have any contact with old colleagues and comrades there telling you about what's going on or other parts of the world?
So actually my factory was in the news, it was in the Guardian and ITV, because there was a secret recording of my old factory manager who was sitting in the canteen, which was full of people, basically threatening them with the sack if they're not turning up to work. Because at one point there was about almost 50% of the workforce apparently weren't coming into work because the company hadn't done anything to protect them, you know. And even I spoke to one woman, and she had even gone to work with a mask, you know, and the managers had said, no, you're not allowed to wear the mask. They weren't providing any masks, they weren't doing anything. And like, this is in Brent, I mean, this is like the hot spot of corona. There's like about, you know, 30 people living in one house. It's like really overcrowded, everyone's got like loads of like health problems. And they're going to that factory, working side by side for hours and hours, like on the assembly line. I mean, this is like high-risk workforce, and they just did fuck all to help them. Didn't put anything in place. So workers did, and because there was no kind of collectivity or no strength amongst those workers to like actually enforce anything or demand anything, and the union wasn't doing anything, the only choice they felt they had was to just not come into work and go off sick. And then what do they get? That factory manager threatening them, saying, oh, well, when I have to make redundancies, you're going to be first on my list, you know. So anyway, this was picked up by the media, and it was like a big kind of hoo-ha about it. Really, like, after the hoo-ha has died down, nothing has changed, you know. The unions thought, because the union is the one that leaked the recording, and they thought, oh, we've got a big win here because we've like embarrassed the company. But like, who cares? I mean, everyone forgets that a week later. And really, what have you got? How does it change how workers feel on the shop floor? You know, we just actually drove past the factory today, and the company had put up a big banner outside going, oh, we're the food heroes, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, fuck off, man. Why don't you pay them a hero's wage then? Yeah. No, it's just so cynical and disgusting how they're behaving.
My feelings on this subject into account. So please stop calling us heroes. It makes it easier for us to die.
No, yeah. From my old workplace, I mean, the drivers, obviously delivery drivers, they were, you know, in big demand. Tesco started paying a bit extra to make sure that everyone comes to work. So it was less threatening, but more like, okay, please come in, you get £1 more an hour or something. Apart from that, not too many kind of things. What we realized, we had like, we were in touch with Amazon drivers, and they, because Amazon obviously made big bucks, they had to deliver so many more parcels for peanuts more. I mean, they got a little bonus, but we really got like conversations going with, let's say, 60, 70 drivers being really pissed off. But again, they're self-employed officially, so according to the labor law, they can't really do any industrial action or union work. And again, that's just like, you know, that's formalism. I mean, obviously they're workers. And so, yeah, we had good discussion with them, but otherwise.
I just kind of also add, maybe another kind of maybe positive tendency is like there's a slight increase in wildcat strikes that we've noticed like in the last 5 years, especially when you look at food manufacturing and food sector. So in the book, we kind of did a bit of a look at like all of the struggles that has happened in the food sector in the UK over the last 5 or 6 years. And there is this kind of tendency of specific groups of workers who will just walk out. These are like migrant workers, you know, or actually during the corona crisis, there was a I think it was meat factory of Two Sisters in Devon, and all mainly Romanian workers, they basically just called in sick. And that even wasn't because of Corona, that was because of some pay issue. Maybe it was related to Corona, I don't know. But, you know, I think if the union is not responding to workers' needs and workers feeling under increasing pressure, which they will do, you know, going on with this sense of like, actually, yeah, we are important and we fucking proved ourselves and where did it get us? That kind of frustration and the lack of channels to deal with it is going to lead to workers kind of doing their own thing. And I think, yeah, man, go for it.
I see the US, like at least since 2008, the US has been a bit of a precursor to what is happening in the UK. I mean, they seem to be always like half a step ahead, and at the moment we see quite a lot of an increase of strike actions in the US. And I think again it's of a different section of the working class. It's not the old kind of industrial core necessarily. It's like it's coming more from the fringes, and I think there might be also like a mutual inspiration both of the protests against the police violence and these type of strikes. I mean, this is nothing that is formalized, and it's not a thing like that you could put your finger on, but I think there's an atmosphere growing with saying, like, no, fuck it.
Well, your book, which I know you were saying, unfortunately, you're not able to tour and talk about at the moment, but hopefully you will be soon. What's it called, and where can I get it?
It's called Class Power on 0 Hours. And you can, if you just type that into Google, you can buy it from the PM Press website.
Just to say in closing, Marco, Kieran, thank you so much for being on All the Rage. Solidarity from the womb to the tomb, and just keep up the great work that you're doing. And please come back on the show anytime you like. You want to talk about something, you want to, once the book tour gets up and running, maybe next year, whatever, just we are your friends. So please reach out. Thanks so much.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.tracksfm.org.